Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm just ducky, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, doing well. I'm doing really, really well. Got back from a lovely, lovely vacation recently.
Yeah.
Got away, little sun, little fun.
Sounds awesome.
It was.
It's funny.
Great.
Your definition of vacation is I imagine herding four children through the airport to get to the plane to Florida. And did you, now you landed in Miami and took
In Lauderdale, yeah.
And then took a puddle jumper to the Keys or drove
in the station wagon
with the rest of the Brady Bunch?
And drove in the minivan, thank you very much, with the rest of the Brady Bunch down to the Keys.
Why don't you teach all your kids to play a musical instrument and then you could start a band?
You know what's funny about that?
What would you do? You could be the manager. That's what you could do.
One of the big attractions down in the Keys.
What is that?
Is this family of like 10, and the oldest is like 21, and the youngest is like 3.
It's called the Partridge Family, Mark.
And,
it was a show in the 70s.
That's what they do. The Dorfels, I think, is
the
their name.
The Dorfels.
And they go, and various children of various ages go on stage and play
songs. I hear it really came together when Mom sang along.
They're actually very good.
You went to see them.
Oh, we did. Oh,
kill
absolutely.
Me. Kill.
Well, they play. We didn't go. I mean, it's a restaurant slash.
Oh, wow, that sounds
theater.
Awesome. The more you talk, the more I'm sorry I missed it.
Sometimes
I'm feeling I regret not having children. I feel
a
little lonely.
You know what? The kids
got to see
a live band. They got to sit right up front. You know, people move kind of in and out while the
Mark,
band's playing.
Yeah. You just said the kids got to see a live band like they went to see a band that mattered.
Well, they didn't go see Kiss, but they went to see the Dorfels.
Mark, Kiss doesn't matter anymore. How did you get older than me? We're the same age.
Kiss still sells out 70,000 person stadiums, okay?
Well.
And people dress up and they paint their faces and do the whole thing.
Yeah, I know. And that Rocky Horror Picture Show, same thing.
I would like to
suggest that we're off topic.
You know what? This doesn't really sound like a food show to me.
We're outside our area of expertise, I promise you. But it was fun. It was a fun little diversion out there.
Well, I did want to talk a little bit about the restaurants down there.
That's what I was going to say. In Florida, now, I know that in the resort cities, and I've been to Miami and had some great food in Miami. But I know that you've also talked about Central Florida being if not a food desert, a food arid place, and certainly a restaurant desert.
Well, the area in the Keys I went to, and I'm going to say we went out.
Well, the Keys are an exception, though, right?
We went out for better, much, much better than, you know, it's really no chain restaurants.
Right.
Okay, which is what Central Florida was, only chain restaurants.
Right.
And what I want to posit is, have we lost the average restaurant? Does that no longer exist? Because it strikes me that you can go out to great restaurants where people are catching their own food and buying from the little purveyor who caught the food this week. And the alternative is all the food arrives frozen in a big Cisco truck and pulls up and gets dropped in the deep fryer. And that's what you're served, and drinks come out of the frosty drink machine.
I think that's been the case for a long, long time. What do you think is different recently? What's changed? I mean, I always remember there being the really mediocre.
Let me give you the example. Okay, a restaurant like a pizzeria in your hometown didn't get delivered necessarily. In the 70s, Cisco or you know, one of the other big companies didn't deliver
I just want to share with you that the pizzeria in your hometown
still doesn't.
The pizzeria in your hometown gets deliveries from this purveyor or bad things happen to them.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's true. I actually just recently went to Scotto's and had some really awesome pizza back in Nutley.
Oh, yeah?
Scotto's is really in Clifton.
We don't
like to tell anybody that. Anyway, so
hold on, you got to give the whole plug. Scotto's in Clifton, New Jersey.
Scotto's in Clifton, New Jersey, right off of Route 3. Really delicious pizza in New Jersey. You know, part of the Nutley pizza wars where people were stuffing the ballot box for their favorite pizza.
And I have to say the Star Tavern survives from when there was an Italian neighborhood in Orange, New Jersey. And the Irish and the Italian go there a lot. And Star Tavern pizza, if you're from the Orange, is
very different. Star Tavern's like that super thin crust. It cooks in like 4 minutes. Scotto's is like that medium crust. You know, not Chicago pizza, but you know, a third of like a Chicago pizza.
And if you want directions to these places, you can just email us, mark@restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll send you. And you can vote for which one of us you think is right.
Oh, very nice.
And it's not the Starlight Pizza in West Orange, which is okay pizza. It's the Star Tavern in Orange, New
Jersey. Very different thing.
Awesome pizza.
Anyway, so I feel like we've lost this mid-range restaurant. This restaurant where they would get fresh food, prepare it simply. And you could go there, and in my case, Italian, that's the kind of food that Nutley was famous for. You'd go to just kind of the average pizzeria and get homemade meatballs and pizza and those kinds of things. I feel like there is no kind of intermediate restaurant anymore. You can either go to a chain or to, you know, which has produced its food in Michigan and shipping to
or it's all the same. Around. It's all the same bland stuff.
Or it's all the same bland stuff that you buy at the depot and drop in the fryer and serve. And I just think that those two camps are getting farther and farther apart, and there are fewer and fewer of the mom and pops. Hey, can I just have a piece of simply grilled fish and,
you know, I have
some
to,
wild rice.
I have to. I don't know that I agree with you. I think that maybe that started to happen 15 years ago.
I think this is a long time. This has been happening for a long time.
I think it's been fairly stable, though, for the last 10 years or so. I mean,
yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the last 10 years or so. I see this huge change from there aren't very many mom and pops that are just doing that simple food. And the ones that are the little mom and pops are buying the Sysco food and dropping it in the deep fryer. And that's what I saw. I saw a lot of that down in the Keys. I saw a lot of that. All the food was the same.
Right.
All the food was dropped into a deep fryer. All the food was either...
Well, when you say it's the same, I mean, you've seen the same large food distribution warehouse calamari in Florida as you see in New Jersey, as you see wherever.
Which is shocking to me.
It looks the same.
You know, and there down there you do have some advantage of there is some fresh fish on some menus. Okay, you can get yellowtail or something that's very, very local and caught. But I'm going to almost say that that's the exception. And as I was down there, I thought, you know, I don't see any really outstanding restaurants down here. I don't see any of that kind of middle-of-the-road restaurants down here. There are a couple of, in the resorts, you have these super high-end restaurants, these really good restaurants. And most of the other places were serving you something frozen that came in a plastic baggie.
You know, I don't know. I think it's very – the opposite is true in big cities, or at least I can speak to New York and Chicago. I think that you're finding there a lot of talented young chefs and a lot of talented young restaurateurs who want to go out and ply their trade, and that almost doesn't fly anymore in Manhattan. I mean, it's funny when you go in and you see – you're around Times Square and you see one of those big chains, and you only see it where there are a lot of tourists because – why would you go there? And I'm always wondering, like, okay, Mrs. Johnson from Oklahoma.
You're in Manhattan. Why are you going to Olive Garden?
Right. You came all the way to New York. You know, we have Italian restaurants here.
Well, that was in Paris when the McDonald's opened on the Champs-Élysées. I was like, why would anybody go to McDonald's on the Champs-Élysées?
Least of all Americans visiting.
You have some of the best food in the whole wide world surrounding you everywhere. I mean, just go to the little guy standing on the corner making crepes, and you have some of the and you're way better off than any McDonald's. I just yearn for that middle-of-the-road restaurant that you can go to that's cooking their own ingredients, and it seems like I can't find it anymore.
You know, but that I say that's true in a lot of places.
Yeah, I mean, in New York City, obviously, you can find that.
And in Chicago.
But go to on a road trip through middle America, and I just don't see that.
No,
I just don't
true.
See it when I'm out in other places.
I would say I agree with you. You know what? If you guys want to let us know what your favorite not-in-a-city, out-of-the-way food destination places are that are not expensive, we would love to hear from you. You can email them to mark@restaurantguysradio.com.
Francis, just so you know, that's going to leave out our two restaurants.
you know, it can. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today, we're very excited, is Gabrielle Hamilton. Gabrielle has a new book out. Her restaurant in New York is Prune, where we've dined several times. And her book is Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef.
Gabrielle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We have to, in the spirit of full disclosure, we have some family ties to disclose to everybody here. We had your sister on the show.
In 05.
So we're kind of working on...
A million years ago.
From Savoir Magazine. She was at Savoir Magazine. So we're going to be working our way through your whole family. You're the second. Welcome aboard.
Gabrielle, I'm sure by now you know this, but you have written now what is, in the restaurant world, probably the most talked about book since Kitchen Confidential came out. It's just, it's got this underground, and I'm sure overground too, I'm sure that you're selling a lot of books, but this underground, you know, handoff from one restaurant person to another restaurant person, you got to read this, you got to read this, you got to read this. How's that feel?
Oh, cool. I'm so glad. Yeah, that's weird, right? I didn't know if it was going to fail on so many levels. I thought maybe it's not foodie enough or not literate enough. And maybe not memoir-y enough. I thought it was going to maybe tank on all fronts. And instead, that has turned out to be the opposite. But it apparently is appealing to all kinds of people, not just restaurant folks. Like people who like memoirs and good writing.
You know, it's
you know, language.
It's funny. One of the things that we've found, I think, in a lot of writing that involves food over the course of the last, 5 years that we've been doing the show and 20 years we've been in business is, you know, there are very few cookbooks anymore that are collections of recipes. And there are very few stories about food or that where food is imperative, part of the narrative, that don't contain some recipes, you know, and I think that your book walks a really unique line, and it is a really powerful memoir, you know, that's more about a love affair with food and how that fits into your whole life.
I really made a decision and a request with Random House, which they were nice to honor, to not include recipes. I just didn't want to be, like, ballless or whatever. Like, I just wanted to be brave and not try and cover all the bases, and if the writing failed, well, at least you'd had a recipe for roast chicken at the end, or if the, if the roast chicken recipe wasn't that good, at least there was a lively head note or a cute little anecdote or story to go with it. And I just thought, can I just either fail completely in one way rather than sort of try to cover all the bases and muck it up and... I mean, I sort of lost the narrative here on what goes on with writing and food writing and books. Like, if you pick up cookbooks, they have a narrative now, and they've turned into, like, mini memoirs or something.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but I just decided to stay focused and, precise in my goal, which was this is going to be a memoir. Once I finally figured out that it was going to be a memoir and made my peace with that, that's how we went.
Okay, so let's talk about the title, Blood, Bones, and Butter.
Yeah, is that all right with you?
Yeah. Can I tell you something? There's no way that I'm not picking up a book that says Blood, Bones, and Butter on it. There's just no, I don't care if it's about, you know, science. I'm picking it up.
Satanic.
It could be about like the French Revolution, you know, for all I know, but I'm picking
right.
it up. So why don't you talk to us about what you mean by Blood, Bones, and Butter, which is not just the title on the cover, but you sort of work that through the book, and it's really fascinating.
Yeah. It was, obviously I handle all those things on an average day as a chef. I'm touching a lot of bones, and you always have some blood on your apron, and certainly at Prune we use butter. But of course they have quantitative value for me of blood, speaking of family and clan, lineage, and then bones, I just was thinking about making one's bones and how one becomes a chef or how I did and opened a restaurant, et cetera. And then the butter was supposed to refer to all the creamy, sweet goodness, the food and the family and the children and those sweet moments. So that's what it was for me. I used to ask people, I didn't want to have a subtitle. I just wanted to leave it at Blood, Bones, and Butter and hope that that would work for people. And I would go around and ask, you know, like a workmate, hey, what does Blood, Bones, and Butter mean to you? And it was not direct like I thought it was. So people would say, oh, it sounds like a satanic sacrificial manual, or just like you said, it's like about the French Revolution.
Right. You know, you know what really screwed you with that, Gabrielle, is Guns, Germs, and Steel was so popular so recently. It sounds like the sequel, you know?
Right. I mean, when you write a book titled Salt, it's pretty clear what that's about, right?
Or, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
God, I should have followed Mark and just made it one or the other.
But, I always said his next book should have been Salt Cod.
Oh, interesting. Salt Cod, Salt Cod. It would have been more of a pamphlet, I think, or Salt Cod. So we got the names down, and this is really
this is funny.
Yeah, that's what we do. We're funny. We're the funny restaurant guys.
Really, we should skip the interview and go for a drink. It's
we can do both. Yeah, how do you know that we're not having a drink?
Yeah, I was going to say we've been drinking all morning.
You're on the phone. I teach wine classes a lot and cocktail classes, and I always start off with Mark and I always start off with a drink in people's hands before we start explaining stuff to them. And I always say, please drink, please have a couple of sips because I'm funnier when you drink. You know, that's
that's right, and better looking.
Exactly, by the hour. So I want to come back to the memoir of your book because it really is wonderful, and for us, it really resonates because Mark and I are from New Jersey, and I've spent a lot of time down those parts where you're from, and so. And I spent
the weekend I got married down there.
And I had an apartment in the East Village. And so, you know, it's always funny when you read a book that's set in places that mm-hmm. you know well. It's like, you know, it's like watching The Sopranos for me and Mark.
And are we anywhere in the same age zone? I'm 45.
We're exactly the same age.
Yeah. Born in 60.
We're both 40.
So you also remember a time that no longer exists.
Precisely.
I mean, the place, yes, but even the place has changed so dramatically.
Exactly. Well, you know what?
You know, 30, 40 years.
We never got down there. So let's take the conversation there because that's where it's going. You're from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, right on the border of New Jersey, where Lambertville and New Hope, there's a bridge that connects New York and New Jersey, which is a wonderful place that I didn't start going to until I came to New Brunswick, because I'm originally from North Jersey. But I came here for college in 83.
Probably 83, 84 is the first time I really went down there. I mean, my grandmother lived in Flemington for a while, so we'd head down that.
Well, I went down. I was working at a restaurant. First time I went there, I was working at a restaurant that's still in existence in New Brunswick. Now, our restaurant's been around for almost 20 years. The Frog and the Peach has been around for 29 years?
83 they opened.
And
right.
And I was working there in 86 as a bartender. I'd just turned 21. And Jim Black and Betsy Alder, the owners, I think it was, took me down to Hamilton's Grill Room, which is in your that restaurant is your family too, right?
That's my father. My father opened that restaurant with my sister in, 87? I don't remember.
87?
Many years ago.
We went down shortly after it opened, and the owners of the restaurant sort of saw me as a, I don't know, they saw that I was very dedicated to being in the restaurant business, and they knew that, you know, I'm a fireman's kid from North Jersey. I'd never been out to a nice restaurant, and they took me out to see the other side of it. And since then, I have a motorcycle, and that's my main place to go on a day trip is down that area.
Yeah.
But it's changed quite a bit. When you were down there in what, the 70s are most of your memories from down there?
Right. So I was born in 65 and I left in, when I graduated high school in 80.
Something.
I mean.
Right. You graduated high school early.
Yeah.
In looking at the book, and I just want to do talk about the early story of the book. You had a very interesting early childhood and mid-childhood. I mean, I think, Francis talked about how the book resonated with him, and I think it will for a lot of people, certainly people who grew up in this area. You know, I was exactly the same age as you. My parents got divorced in the late 70s. You had a very different experience, though. I mean, my parents, when they got divorced, you know, they were so far up my butt, I couldn't fart without blaming the dog. You know, there's you know, there was.
They continued the parent. Mm-hmm.
There was. There,
but how
not,
many kids in your family?
There were two of us.
Yeah.
And my brother was my brother was 18 and going off to college, and I was kind of the
one. So there was one of you. There was one child.
I was 13, and I was still home, and they just kind of ratcheted up, and I kind of got double the amount of parenting that I was getting. That wasn't really the case for you, was it?
No. I mean, I think that is exactly a product of how many kids there were, and they had to go, you know. By the time that marriage was ending, I mean, I can't explain them. I don't really know what was going on for them. I just know that my next brother, you know, I'm the youngest and the next one, we were left alone in the house that we grew up in for a summer.
And this
is... I was 12 or 13, and that was it. That's when adulthood started. We got jobs. We made our own money. It was the definitive end of childhood. Prior to that, childhood had been idyllic. I mean, it was a cherished and spectacular time for me in that rural setting, and I had these bohemian, amazing parents, and there were dinner parties and such exposure, and we traveled and we ate, and I loved my siblings, you know. It was a time when you could still talk about how much you loved your brothers and sisters without sounding, you know, weak or
well, I think
you
can,
or whatever.
I think you can still do that, and I don't think that's too.
I think you can do it again.
So yeah, exactly. So how old were you when you found yourself alone in the house in rural Pennsylvania?
I think that was my 13th summer.
Wow. And then you graduated. You were able to sort of maintain your way through, and you graduated high school when you were 16.
Yeah. So I skipped sort of parts of some grades and cobbled together my credits in various ways. And it was an alternative high school, and I was good at English, and no one cared that I was terrible at math, but I had maturity or precociousness or something. So I got out of there when I was 16 and started at NYU when I was 16, and then tanked out in, half a semester because I was getting into some serious drugs and thievery, and I was starting my life of true badass rebellion and hastened adulthood, or what I thought looked like hastened adulthood. So I was swearing and smoking and doing coke and ripping off the Lone Star Cafe. And then, I got in some big freaking trouble bigger than me and way out of my league, and I kind of sobered up a little bit, and I went backpacking around the world, essentially. I mean, I took a stab at a different college, dropped out of that, saved up $1,200 to $1,200 and went halfway around the world for a couple of years. And when I got back from that, I feel like I started more of a path of adulthood.
Well, I do think, and I say this to everybody, and people who listen to the show have heard me say similar things before. There's something about going to other countries and other places in the world and seeing how differently they run their lives and operate every day than we do, that does give you a world perspective. It's a different perspective, and I encourage anybody who hasn't really done some traveling, if you're 18, 19, 20 years old and you can spend a little time in Europe or in some other countries, that you definitely should do that.
I know. I think parents freak out when their kids say that they're dropping out of college or that they're going to postpone going to college. But it's an education of its own that can't be had in a university and should be done. And it's harder to do, as you know, as you get older and have kids or responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very likely that you're going to uproot yourself and put your backpack on and go schlep through youth hostels for a couple of years. So you should do it when you're young.
You know, the other thing I always suggest, because we have in the restaurant business, there's always there are people of all different ages who work for us, and we have some folks who work for us. And one of the things that I like about the 20-year-olds that I meet or the 21-year-olds that I meet is they're kids who actually have to pay the rent or, you know, helping pay their way through school. And I find I enjoy talking to them more because there's this – they're out there more than someone whose parents is paying for school and they're just sort of sailing through. I don't find them to be as engaging to talk with or as interesting to talk with. But one of the things that I always say to people when they're sort of deciding what to do, and when you're talking to somebody who's not a rich kid whose parents are going to bankroll them whatever they do, they should go. You should take advantage of that. I celebrate that. Enjoy that. I wish I had it. But when you're talking to somebody who's got to pay the rent and they're like, listen, I'm going to go to law school and I'm going to buckle down, and and I'm thinking about maybe taking a year off to travel. You know, there's a difference between travel and tourism. And to travel when you're young is to embrace the possibility that you might not come back.
That's right.
And when you have a mortgage or a business or kids, you're coming back.
Or all of those things.
Mark just got a little sad.
I mean, and any kid who can wash dishes or make salads is going to find work along the way. Mm-hmm. So it's not for just the people who've been bankrolled by their parents. I mean, by any stretch, you can go and you can join that sort of backpacking circuit of work to be done. There's always a well to be dug or, you know, oranges to be picked or hotel beds to be made and rooms to be cleaned. So there's work to finance your trip along the way.
I agree. That brings us to your trip. I think in your trip, you really – you maybe weren't as well prepared as a kid who's willing to work a little here or there teaching English and has the photo's guide and, you know, the city search to help them through. You actually – you dealt with, you know, not having enough to eat quite a bit. And that sort of – you write about how that influenced your view on food. You want to talk to us about that a little bit?
It did, really. I starved so much and worried about money and fretted when I would eat again. I mean, let's be clear. I was broke. I'm not a poor person. I'm educated. We grew up with a lot of, exposure and luxury. But that's true. For this two-year period, I was bedraggled and freaked out and often, you know, alone on some train platform in the middle of India and sort of wondering, like, well, how am I going to get all the way back home? Because right now I have $263 left. And during those starving and terrified periods, people will feed you and take care of you and are hospitable. And I'd never forgotten not only the act and the gesture, but that's your sense of hospitality. I wish I could translate into my own restaurant where the customer arrives I don't know how to explain this. You're not a chooser and you're not in charge and you're not the bossy person who is the connoisseur of your whole experience. Like when you're totally down and out and someone gives you a sandwich, you're not going to ask if it's vegetarian or say, I don't like mustard. You know, you're just going to eat the sandwich and be so glad that someone gave that to you.
I think I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. I didn't want to interrupt.
No, I'm not sure I could. I have more.
I've read where you said in talking about the food, I think this may have come from your website. I don't remember if it was in the book or the website. It's all running together now. But I read where you said something about the food in your restaurant being different from very fancy contrived foods, I guess would be the word I would use. You know, things with foams and very carefully presented, crab cocktails in a martini glass. Because that's food that no one would ever make or conceive of or craves when they're hungry. You know, it's artifice. And I thought, wow, that's pretty profound, you know. No one, when you're hungry, you're not really caring about the, you know, the artifice of. Do you think food's gotten a little too?
No, I very clearly did not want to open a concept or a conceptual place or an intellectual stimulator where you're looking at the food and you're having your mind blown. To me, that's way too self-referential, and it's all about the chef, and that is not how I grew up to understand the service industry. I was sure that the service industry was supposed to be about taking care of the customer, and not in that way where, you know, the customer can walk all over you and be inappropriate. Like, you know, it's an art to be served and to serve. Both people need to know what they're doing. So I think what I wanted to do, though, is have food that you would crave again and again, stuff that, you know, it's 4:30 and you're having that little plunge and you're not craving somebody's olive oil beads on top of uni. I can't even make it up right now. I'm trying to make some joke about molecular
olive oil beads on top of a fried mayonnaise frozen nitrogen ice cream of trout.
Yes, exactly, with something that looks like an apple but is actually a frog leg. Or that's right.
Or a paper menu that you eat when you're done reading it, like Maxwell Smart.
Which has been faxed to your table.
Like
I mean, those things
Smart.
Are fascinating. That stuff is totally cool, and I do like to check that out when I'm feeling like I'm really loaded and I have a lot of money and I can burn money and I just want to go and see what the kids are doing. That's perfectly interesting to me. But on a workaday basis, when I'm, I have hard-earned money and I want to spend it on a meal that's incredibly satisfying, I want to be served very nicely, I'm not going for that.
Well, you know, I don't know where you two grew up, but my mom cooked exactly like that when I was a kid. Or at least the pork chop tasted like they were made of newspaper. I'm not sure. We're gonna take a quick break, and we'll be back with Gabrielle Hamilton. Her book is Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. And you can find out more about that at restaurantguysradio.com. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. We're talking with Gabrielle Hamilton about her book, Blood, Bones, and Butter, and also about your restaurant, which we should give a little plug to the restaurant. So it's a really charming spot down on you're on First Street, right?
Yep, between First and Second Avenue
between
in
First
the East
and
Village.
You know, I went to that restaurant. What year did you open there?
91?
99.
No, 99.
99. Because I used to go down there first. I had an apartment in the East Village on Second Avenue in St. Mark's, and and that was when Sam DeMarco opened First. Right around there. It was about the
right.
That was right. It was right before you, right?
I think actually they were after, but I can't be sure. Maybe it was before.
Yeah, but
right around the same time.
They're close around the same time.
I know. I just heard this quote, like Marco Canora saying, like he was the first person to open a restaurant in a neighborhood of that caliber, and I was like, hold on, you.
Okay.
Whoa. we were here way before you.
Can I tell you what's funny? Is Mark and I operate restaurants in Jersey, obviously, and. We, the genesis of this radio show, when I was like, I really want to do it, and then eventually the things fell into place and it happened.
I thought it was when they came to us and said, do you want to do a radio show?
They had been doing that for years, but I was listening to the Leonard Lopate show on another radio station, and he was interviewing Ruth Reichel, who's lovely and been on our show, and Drew Nieport, who lives in New Jersey, and they made some joke about, and we opened in 92, so we had been open for 13 years at this point, and they made some joke about restaurants in New Jersey, like Drew lives in New Jersey but would never eat in New Jersey. It was a totally innocent joke, but here I am driving down the road yelling at the radio. And that's exactly it. And I like Leonard Lopate, and I've since met him, and Ruth has been on the show, and Drew hasn't been on yet, but we'll get him soon. But you know, I often feel like we were cooking with Austrian roasted pumpkin seed oil in 1994, and
right.
I remember reading...
In the fine state of New Jersey.
In the fine state of New Jersey.
And we were using seasonal produce.
Right, I've been going to the green market since 92.
Making handcrafted cocktails in the 90s.
With
Dale
DeGroff in 93.
I mean...
And so I would read about these things, like, so we're using Austrian roasted pumpkin seed oil in 94, and in 2000 I read about how it's the coolest thing in New York, and they've just discovered it. And I'm like, you bastards, I've been sending you press releases for 8 years. I know what that's like.
It happens all the time, right? It's not, you know, there are several innovators before the person emerges who's identified as the innovator.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, No one is ever the first. They get identified as the first, or they think they're the first, and they're not. And Florida is certainly not the first, independent 30-seat, we're going to do it my way restaurant that existed in New York City. But
it might be the only one left, though.
We were one of the first.
Well, Gabrielle, it might be the only one left, though.
Or certainly the only one with that tenure, which is an interesting thing to talk about. Obviously, you're a very celebrated chef, and if people want to look up, what's been written about you, they can Google you and see that your food has been super well regarded, not just in New York, but across the country and around the world. I'm sure that you've had opportunities to expand your empire, yet you've chosen to stay with Prune and to actually cook in your own restaurant quite a bit.
I know. It took me, I think, 10 years to figure out that I didn't want another restaurant. Sometimes I have had that feeling like, am I supposed to keep up with my neighbors or, my colleagues who are all opening lots of places? And sometimes I have money envy. I have to admit that I have made a commitment to this kind of nonprofit existence, because a 30-seat restaurant, we pay our bills and everyone gets their salary paid, but it's not like we're printing money. And I know people are confused by that because they see the line at brunch and it's just crazy packed and the restaurant's always busy. But those are people who don't understand the economy.
I was going to say, you're talking to two restaurateurs here? We get it.
Yeah.
We get
that's
it.
That's right. I just think the general world doesn't know that. But so I have at times wanted to, frankly, be wealthier and not live in an East Village one-bedroom tenement apartment with two children. Like, that sometimes feels very hard on a 45-year-old woman. You think, wasn't I supposed to be more grand than this by this age? But in the end, I love my restaurant, and I can pay attention to it, and I can take care of it. And it's not like the only thing I have going on in my life. I mean, I do have these kids. I do want to write, and I have just written a book. And for me, that's a very full day mm-hmm. to do all of those things in one. So if I had three restaurants across town or one in a resort place, I just feel like I would be pouring water into the soup and diluting it and diluting it.
Wow.
And it would have a kind of, it would have a mercenary feel to it. There's something about Prune when you walk in, you're like, this is not about money.
Mm-hmm.
People
mm-hmm.
working here give a shit. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're allowed to say that on the radio. But
it'll make the podcast.
They care, and I care, and you can still feel that.
Well, to illustrate that very point, there's a story about you that I would hope that you would share with our listeners about you actually screened to be the next Iron Chef, is it?
Yeah.
And I think that was a beautiful moment that I think is really important to sort of, I don't know if I do understand you, but if I do, it was really important to sort of getting a picture of who you are. And I think it was great of you to go and try, but I don't think they're used to getting people turn them down very much. I don't think that's happened very often.
I think you're right. I am not very attracted to these shows, these reality competition shows. Like, I'm very interested in chefs who can cook, and that's kind of exciting to watch, but you don't see much of that anymore. And I had done Iron Chef. I had battled Bobby Flay and won, so I felt like, okay, I can put that whole experiment to bed. I'm done. But the producers called for this other thing called Who Will Be the Next Iron Chef or something like that.
Right.
And I said, oh, no, thanks. I'm not really interested. And she continued and got my hot button. And she said, we're having such difficulty finding women.
There you go.
Right. Exactly. And I was like, what? Well, if you need women, it's my duty and my
yeah.
You must
represent your gender.
The first step, and I said, well, I'll send you my reel or whatever I've done in TV so far, and you can take a look. And I thought that would be the end of it. And then, of course, they call back, you're perfect. So can you go to the second screening thing? And I kept going along, not really wanting to do it, but thinking it was my obligation. And then she just caught me off guard. You had the on-screen interview, and she says, so why are you just dying to be the next Iron Chef? And I was deadly silent, just absolutely stopped in my throat with language. And I was like, I just so don't. Her shoulders sort of slumped down and she leaned over and clicked off the camera.
I don't know if that made the show. Did
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I didn't see that part. So why do you want to be the next Iron Chef? And the answer is, I don't.
It's so funny, even with this book thing that's happening, it turns out that I'm not interested in being famous in any way. It does not appeal to me. I really love getting critical reviews that are positive. Like, I love feedback and the positivity of that. It's nice to be judged in a way. I didn't say that the right way.
I know
it's
what you're
saying. To have done hard work and to be rewarded with good feedback.
Right. To know that other people think your work is excellent.
That's right.
Well, I have to say this book as a memoir, it is very enriching to read it. It's a lot about, how to live life and get the most out of every minute. And we don't have time to go into it in the show.
If we weren't a food show, we still would have had you on the show.
Well, and I don't want to go into it on the show because we got to give them a reason to buy the book, right? We got to get you out of that studio apartment. When you talk about your marriage and your kids and, what you thought would have been right and what went wrong about your marriage and the sort of the introspection of it all, you feed people in your restaurant, but I think this book is really nourishing as well to read. So, if it's received well, if it's accomplishing its purpose, it makes people's lives better.
It's incredible that you said that because I didn't – many people cite the fact that I have an MFA in fiction writing. And I cannot find any time that I actually used that education in the writing of the book. However, I did come to the writing of the book with all of my chef experience behind it, in that I felt important to take care of the customer, and in this case, the reader, and to give them something. I felt like if I'm going to ask for your time, I should really give you something. And I did not want to write one of those books that's... So let me tell you another thing about myself. It's really interesting about me. I mean, I wrote a memoir, it's true, but I tried to write it as big as I possibly was capable of and as much about you and others and people in life as I could and not make it my silly little story while I navel gaze. So I'm glad that you felt nourished by it. That was the chef in me, I'd like to think.
I did, and you'll have to buy the book in order to figure out what I'm saying.
This is a book that people are going to talk about for years. This is not, one of those books that comes across your desk. Francis and I read a lot of books. We talk to a lot of authors. This is not one of those books. This is one of those books that will remain in the public consciousness for a long time.
And you'll have to buy And you'll have to buy the book to figure out what I'm saying, but... the prescription there is that we all need to cut down the trees so that we can see the ocean once in a while. Gabrielle, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The book is Blood, Bones, and Butter. You should pick it up immediately. Like, dial on your little PDA right now and pick it up. It's by Gabrielle Hamilton. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and go to Prune for dinner. It's really great. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. So, yeah, did you like that I left them with the teaser there? They got to buy the book.
That was good.
I have to say.
I can't imagine. Okay. Now, you need to read the book to really get the full impact of this. But at 13 years old, it was 1978, exactly the same time that her parents got divorced, my parents got divorced, and we're exactly the same age. And I can't imagine them both saying, hey, you know what? Gotta do my own thing and going off and doing their own thing. And I can't imagine what that would have done to me. My father moved two blocks away because he was like, I want to be parenting here.
And you didn't know, you were wishing he had moved away and they would leave you alone in the house, but you didn't really want, that wouldn't have been good.
It wouldn't have been good, but they turned up the volume. I mean, no doubt about it. It was like, okay, you're going to go through a tough time. You're at that weird age where everybody's going through a tough time. We're going to turn up the volume. And in her case, they turned down the volume, and she just kind of had to go out and find out on her own. And obviously, there's a life experience there, and that's what we were talking about traveling through Europe. That life experience is something that people whose parents pay for everything and just kind of are shadowing over them all the time, they don't get those types of life experience. You and I both spent a fair amount of time on our own in Europe when we were in college. And I just, those life experiences, there's nothing you can trade for, though. There's no other preparation for that.
And let's go on, because, I mean, she took it to another level. You and I went to Europe. Now, your dad had a French export
sure,
company.
Sure, I had a home base where there was a family that I could stay with. And whenever I got a little nervous or ran out of money, frankly, I could go back there. Right. I never worried about going hungry unless I traveled on a Sunday when every place was closed.
Well, and you can go hungry in about 4 hours. You're hungry. You know what I'm saying? You and me. But no, I didn't have that experience. I didn't have the family there. I went with my buddy Kurt, and we traveled mm-hmm. around, and we had saved up more money than she did. And let's face it, we stuck to Europe. Okay, mm-hmm. Europe is a lot easier. We're in a Western European American culture. Our culture is a Western European culture. So understanding, and you speak French, and I speak
speaking
Spanish.
French, right, exactly.
So, you know, how much do we really challenge ourselves? India on a train platform in the middle of the night. That's what you call challenging yourself. But I have to say, having read this book, and we knew of Gabrielle Hamilton because we know her family. We know Hamilton's
Grill. Know the restaurant, exactly.
Hamilton's Grill
Room. Interviewed her sister, right.
Hamilton's Grill Room in Jersey as well as Prune in New York, her dad's restaurant in Jersey. And I'd always heard good things about her, and I don't know, we may have some mutual acquaintance. But having read this book and now having spoken with her, it just strikes me that she is a person of tremendous integrity.
I think integrity is the word that first comes to mind when you think of her.
And it's really awesome to read. And you know, this memoir was very nourishing to the soul. It's a lot about what's important in life. And it's not told to you like a fairy tale, and mm-hmm. here's the moral lesson to that. But if you're sensitive at all, or maybe I'm just inclined to feel like, you know, she's got her really finger on the pulse of what's important in life. And I like it in the book. And it's also, it's fun and interesting, and hopefully she'll come up with a companion cookbook next time around. Well, I hope you all have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. We are the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
And you're listening to us on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.